Live from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, the Total Education Show, the talk shop for teachers, parents, and administrators. Here's your host of the show, Neil Haley, the Total Tutor.
We're back to the Total Education Network, Total Education Celebrity Show on the Total Education Network, TotalTutor.net for more information. Twitter, Total Tutor, Neil S. Haley, Facebook. And I really enjoyed this guest. And I'm so glad I said, we're only going to do one segment so we can have her back on. And from that day on, I know she has been nonstop with the book and everything. So I want to welcome the program celebrity Lisa Chapman from Dog and the Bounty Hunter and much, much more. Lisa, how are you?
I'm fabulous. Thank you for having me.
Oh, I'm excited to talk to you as well. And it's always a pleasure. And your story is just absolutely amazing. And just to take our listeners back to the last time we had our interview, we were at the point where you went back to see your father. You were rock bottom. You wanted to change your life. You saw how your father's life changed. So take us from where we left off right there with the story. So basically, what happens next?
So I come off the plane in Hawaii and I catch a cab to my dad's house. It was about 6 a.m. in the morning. And I remember it was a limo taxi and I thought, wow, this is really fancy. And so I take a taxi and I pull up and literally I pull up in the driveway and boom, there's a camera in my face. And I'm like, what's going on here? I wasn't really sure. And I was kind of thrown into, this Hollywood, New Yorker lifestyle with all these producers and high-end people. And I was just, this teen mom drug addict, homeless previously. And I was completely in culture shock. I didn't know how to carry a conversation. I didn't know what to order at the restaurants. I remember opening menus and just looking for a cheeseburger because cheeseburgers are something that I understood to be on the menu. So it was a complete culture shock for me.
I mean, thinking about that and cameras in your face, no media training at all, not knowing what to expect, because I don't think you were watching your dad on television where you were at when you disappeared.
No. I was homeless, so I didn't have
to. Oh, that's another cause we definitely have to talk about with you as well, Lisa. I mean, so you're like, oh, my. And you're shocked at where your dad had come from. Because when you grew up with him, it was a lot of poverty. And to see the change based on the TV show must have blown you away.
Yeah, it was incredible. I mean, I went to the grocery store with my dad, and he, first of all, he would tell me, pick anything you want in the grocery store. And I would look at him like, are you crazy? And he was like, you can get whatever you want. And so I would go over and grab like a Lunchable for me and Abby to share. And he was like, what is that? And I'm like, a Lunchable, And he was like, Lisa, get food, So, and then we get to the checkout line and everyone's whispering and Dog the Bounty Hunter. And it seemed like, my dad had always been a legend in his own mind my whole life. And now other people knew who he was and, that's the daughter. So I had gone from this big, from being this drug addict to being Dog the Bounty Hunter's daughter literally overnight. I was thrown into this, completely different lifestyle. So it was almost like pretending. I had to pretend to talk like them and eat like them. And, it was really, really incredible.
And what you saw from here when you had conversations with your father's like, if you're going to be with me, I want to see you overcome what I was able to overcome, right? He had those conversations with you from the beginning saying, here are the ground rules. If you're going to stay with me, I expect this, that, and the other. And if you're not going to, then I'm going to have to cut you off pretty much, right? He's being straight with you because he doesn't want to see you hit rock bottom again.
He gave me a lot of time to adjust. He gave me adjusting time. They gave me a couple weeks to kind of get my feet, get my bearings. And then they slowly started putting responsibilities on me, taking care of the kids, helping with the housework. If I was going to be staying in the house, I needed to pull my own weight. And on top of that, they were filming a TV show and it was, fastly growing. We were still in season one at the time. Season one was just airing and we were filming season two. So, they were like, you got to pull your weight. Absolutely.
I could just imagine. And how old were you at this point?
I was 17.
Oh, my gosh. I mean, I know 17-year-olds because I'm preparing them for the SAT. And they would not, with a child, they would not be ready for this responsibility. And especially with television, it's amazing. I'm sure you have a reaction sometimes when you see other teenagers on reality television, how they're kind of exposed at times. What is your response in that sometimes when you see those things happen? It doesn't seem like your father did that in a way. It was just part of the family, but other people really put them in too much involvement at that age.
Yeah. I think it's just kind of sad, you know. So much we push our children to grow up, and children are in such a hurry to grow up. I think it's kind of really sad. And I think that the partying lifestyle is also really sad because, I mean, once you've done that, you know where it leads, you know what it gets you, and you know where you're headed. So once you've been through that and you see people going through it, you wish that you could just give them the answers. You know what I mean? Like, don't make these mistakes. Let me show you what happens. Let me show you what's going to happen to your future, because we know it's kind of like, the sun will go down every night. You know, it's an inevitable fact of what that lifestyle leads to.
Well, absolutely. And it's something where where to go next? And still you are suffering from, you're not healed, right? You're still a drug addict when you get there, correct?
Yeah. I remember a lot of people from AA worked for my parents. They built floats. They helped at the office. They were just like a really, you know, really supported the family and the business. And so I remember going to like a big AA dance that they had on this New Year's Eve, and we were with some friends. And I just remember looking around at this group of people, and I thought, man, one of these people has to know where to score something good. I was like, one of these people is going to fall off the wagon. One of these people is going to, you know, show me where to get the hookup. Because I looked around at all these drug addicts, and I was like, oh, yeah, I hit the jackpot here. So I was just doing everything I could. I was trying. I didn't know anyone, so I tried as hard as I could to score. And, you know, a couple weeks later, I eventually did.
Oh, and what was your father's response on that? Did he think you were clean when you came? That he said, "Yeah, I want you to be clean. You better not go on drugs." Did he have an ultimatum with you when he first came?
Not really. You know, it was just kind of an unspoken thing. It was very unspoken. They didn't really think that I would be able to find drugs. They had really no idea. And then they'd left town. And that was when I was able to score, when they were out of town. And one of the kids and I had got to a spat or something, and I called my dad, and he was like, "God, you can't do this," and blah, 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 "what's going on with you?" And so I popped the plane back to Alaska. So actually, after my 6-week stint in Hawaii, I went back and did 6 weeks more in Alaska. I got pissed off. I packed all my stuff, and I said, "Screw this, I'm going home." So I went back to Alaska for 6 weeks and just completely stayed high the whole time. And when my show aired, I was actually in Alaska, the first episode of season 2, Baby's Back in Town, and I'm sitting in front of this TV in Alaska at my mom's house, and I thought, oh, my God, you know, what did I give up? What did I do? And I called my dad, and I was like, "Oh, I'm really sorry. Can you just go ahead and fly me back now?"
So you saw it.
I'll do good, I promise. And so after he flew me back that second time, I completely quit using drugs. That was when I realized that, you know, if I wanted a different life, I had to stop getting high.
So I'm confused on that, and because I'm shocked, Lisa, that you literally, in a way, just said, "I have to quit." After you saw the lifestyle back in Alaska, you're like, "I have to get back there, and I want to make a change in my life." And you just decided to do it.
What every day is about. I mean, it is a choice. Happiness is a choice. Living life is a choice. You know, it really is a choice, and that was the choice. I knew. I mean, there are certain things you have to choose to do. If you choose to wake up at 7 o'clock in the morning and do things, then you know that you can't stay up till 3 o'clock in the morning. You know, it's choice. And I think that that's what stops so many people from getting clean and from having productive lives, is they don't realize that it's just a choice that you can make. You know, just as easy as, you know, am I going to take the long way home from work?
So did you have to go through any rehabilitation, or you just finally just said, "I decided I'm done"? That was it?
No, I had no rehabilitation, no rehab, no nothing. I just went cold turkey and quit and did everything I could to... I actually, when I got back to Hawaii, I scored one more time, and I had it, and I never smoked. I was crack, and I had it, and I had stashed it up in my closet, and I hid it. And I never smoked it. I ended up a couple days later flushing it down the toilet because I was just over it. But having it gave me the feeling like I was high. And so I was shaking for 2 days. I felt like I was having withdrawals. And then finally, I just went up in that closet. I grabbed the dope out. I threw it in the toilet. I flushed it. And that feeling was gone. And I was like, wow, this is very, very powerful. And for an addict, especially someone who was very poor, to flush your stash is like crazy, yes. You know what I mean? So it was very empowering for me to have the power over that drug rather than it having power over me.
So what do you think made you do that? I mean, honestly, what helped you in this process? You didn't have the help of rehab. You just had help in your spirit to say, I can do this.
Absolutely, and it was more than wanting a better life for me. It was wanting a better life for my children. When I looked at my daughter and I would see her and I would stay up all night and then have to get up with her in the morning, you know, I knew I didn't want to be that type of parent. I didn't want to be the mother that I had. I didn't want to be the father that I had. You know, I wanted to be someone that she could depend on. And I didn't, when I thought of her in, you know, 10 years getting high, I would just cringe. And so I thought, you know, I've got to change my life. It's not for myself, but for this little girl who has no choice. You know, when you're a child, you don't have a choice what type of home you're built into. And you have to give them the best, you know, every opportunity that you can. And when I looked at her, I thought, you know, I'm not going to let her end up like I did.
And I think that's, you have to be commended for that. So then I guess everything changes. Now, Lisa Chapman kind of developing a little bit of a celebrity status from your first stint on Dog the Bounty Hunter. You come back, you get clean, and then your dad gives you more responsibility, correct?
Yeah, I started doing everything around the house. I started taking the kids to school, picking them up from school, doing all the laundry, all the shopping, all the cooking. And I had my nephew, Travis, who was three, my daughter, who was three, Bonnie and Gary were 5 and 7, and Cecily was 12. So I had 5 kids, and I'd take them to the grocery store, all my little towhead blondies, and I'd make them hold hands in a line, and people would go, oh my gosh, look at that girl with all those babies, you know. And I just completely took over being, you know, the house. Dad and Beth were always out bounty hunting, and so I took over all the house responsibilities. I just completely ran the home. And then I started working as Beth's assistant. If she needed anything, I would get it for her. If, you know, as well as filming Dog the Bounty Hunter, they're also running 3 businesses at the same time. There's Dog Corp, there's the Bail Bonds Company, there's T-shirt shops. I mean, there's lots of other things. So I began helping her with her other tasks during the day. And then one day they needed a decoy, and they said, you know, let's call Baby Lisa. We need someone that nobody knows. And I was just so upset. I was like, I did not want a bounty hunt. I am not a bounty hunter. I never want to be a bounty hunter. You know, this is not what I want to do. And my dad looked at me, and it's really funny because it's on one of the episodes, and he goes, do you want to eat? And I said, do I want to eat? And he goes, yeah. I go, Dad, we just had lunch. He goes, no. He goes, you don't understand. He goes, do you want to eat? I go, of course I want to eat. And he goes, well, then you got a bounty hunt.
Wow.
So
that's something you just didn't want to be part of because you saw your dad from the beginning when what bounty hunters were till the television show. And you said, no, please don't put me involved in that life. Because again, you get involved in that, you're going to get back into the drug scene because you have to be part of the noise that's around you when you're chasing these criminals.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah, and I remember doing bus, and we would sign dope on people, and I would think, man, look at all that. Like, I would be in heaven for a week if I had that, you know? I just, you know, it was hard. It was the drug lifestyle. It was kind of like being a rat or a narc at the same time. You know, you didn't want that stigma on you. And I was still, you know, a drug addict at heart, you know, so I didn't want to be a rat. And, you know, there was a lot of things that made me not want any part of bounty hunting at all. And I just couldn't keep out of it. And then the next thing you know, I'm a full-fledged member on the team, and I'm hunting with them, and I'm doing directions, and I'm really getting into it. You know, there is nothing like hunting another man. It's incredible. And especially when you're bounty hunting, you learn everything about them, what they do, who their mother is, what happened to their life, and you become obsessed with them almost. And when you finally do catch them, it's not like you want to wrestle them to the ground and throw handcuffs on them. You're like, dude, I'm so sorry. I can't believe your mom did that. Or, you know, I can't believe this happened to you in your life. It's kind of like we're doing right now, you know, where you just want to know more about their story because for weeks or months or days even, you have been completely wrapped up in their lives and know everything about them. So when you finally do see them, it's this incredible rush that is better than getting high.
All right. So when we get back, we're going to be more with Lisa Chapman. And Lisa, your story is surprising me because I thought we're going to talk about rehab and all these things. And you just, your strength. And when you said about taking the five kids to the grocery store, my wife will have to do those things. And I think that you'll have to, because I'm expecting our fifth, that you'll have to have a conversation with her one time to say, how are you able to handle that? Because she thinks it's you're not able to do it. You have to tell about how you did that, because I guess what you went through in your life. So when we get back, more with Lisa Chapman. You're listening to Toll Education Celebrity Show on the Toll Education Network, and we'll be back in just a moment. We're back to the Toll Education Celebrity Show on the Toll Education Network. TotalTutor.net for more information. Twitter, Total Tutor Neil S. Haley. Facebook, check out all those different places. I'm with Lisa Chapman from Dog and the Bounty Hunter Celebrity. And she's her book's out, and she's doing much, much more. And we're learning her story. And it's part three of the story. And now we're learning that you're becoming this expert bounty hunter, which a job you never wanted. That's what's the funniest thing. You never wanted to do this.
Yeah, I wanted no part of the family business. I was happy taking care of the kids. You know, I was happy. My mom was a stay-at-home mom, and my whole life she had talked about how staying at home was the best thing you could do for your kids. And so I was happy to stay at home. I definitely didn't want to go back to work. But once I did, I really did love it. I loved bounty hunting. You know, I loved everything about it.
And good. What I was going to say, Lisa, so basically you were tracking in the excitement of the hunt and to capture. Were you ever fearful of your life, especially when you were not as trained as your father and definitely not as big as your father, that he really could take care of people? Being able to track the most dangerous people in the world, it's got to be scary at times.
It was scary, but at the same time, you have so many emotions going on that you don't really have time for fear. Everything else kind of outweighs it. I mean, right before you hit a house, I mean, you know that the guy's in there, you get the call, and they say, for sure, he's in there, and this is someone you've been looking for 2 weeks, and someone says, but for sure, he has a gun. And so right before you hit that house, I mean, every emotion in your body is going crazy. Am I going to get shot? Are my brothers going to get shot? You know, it wasn't hunting with a bunch of SWAT guys. This was my family. So, I mean, the fear was there, but it was so much greater. The watch for the person and the hunt and everything else that went along with it was so much more important, you know. So you kind of put fear on the back burner because fear is what gets you killed. So we were bad people, and we were going to go in there and we were going to rock it. You know, we never let fear get to us.
And that's tremendous that you didn't allow fear to get to you. So through that process, the notoriety comes because you're on the TV show now. Really
right.
On the TV show. How did you handle fame? How did you handle social media at that point? It probably was just Facebook, or probably it was just blogosphere at that time. But how did you handle that you really are, when you walk around, people recognized you? Was that really strange from being homeless to a celebrity?
Yeah. I adored it. It took me back to when I was a kid and I was, neglected by my parents, and I would sit all day in my treehouse and just think about what my life would be one day. And I remember when I used to spend hours and hours outside in Hawaii because my dad was always, in his closet doing drugs. And so I would just sit outside by myself, and I had a little TV show, and it was more like a talk show, and I had a co-host, and I'd sit in my chair every day and talk about current events, very similar to like Regis and Kelly. And so when people started recognizing me, I would go back to that treehouse and I'd think, my gosh, it's all coming true. You know, this is exactly what I dreamed of and this is what I hoped for. And still to this day, when people smile at me, I give everyone a wave and I give everyone a smile. And I am very, very humble. And they're like, oh, it's you, it's Lisa. And I'm like, no, it's just Lisa, just me. I'm very, very humble. And I think fame is in direct relation to how much you want it. You know what I mean? And it's not really something that I want. It's not the notoriety. It's really to help people and to, get the word out there about a wholesome person. So it's kind of, it's very flattering. It's very humbling. And I just adore it. And I make sure love all my fans.
Well, I mean, that's so special. And in a lot of ways, your childhood dream of getting to be on television, I'm sure that maybe there's a dream of being a talk show host someday.
Yeah, I'd love to. I'm working on my show right now. That's actually something we've really been talking about. I've had a lot of new developments since we talked last. I was in L.A. I pitched to a bunch of networks, and I've recently brought in my brother on the project because my brother, Dwayne Lee, who was on the show with us for 8 years, went to him and I said, listen, brother, I need some help on this show. I'm going to need a man. So I pulled my brother into my new project also, so it's just been going really well.
So you're pitching it to places, so we can't hear anything more, and I want to go back into the story and maybe ask you more about it. So basically, as for our listening audience that doesn't understand, even reality television shows, they're not just saying, oh, they cast right off the bat. No, you basically sell it to production company. The production company goes and then sells it to one of the big networks. So it's more about you getting the whole project together, then going to the networks and figuring out which network wants it. Am I correct?
Right.
So.
Right. But yeah, getting back into the story. So I'm, you know, on Dog the Bounty Hunter. We're probably in our fifth season. I was engaged to this wonderful man whom I thought was, you know, going to be my king, and I loved him with all my heart. And we got married. I got pregnant on the show. I gave birth on the show. I went through all these emotional things on the show. And the thing about in this lifestyle is that everywhere you go, there's open bars. People are drinking. It's very acceptable. Well, for an addict, even drinking is really bad. I cannot even take Tylenol because I get addicted. I can't take nothing because I'm like, oh, I need that. You know, I have a very addictive personality. So when I began drinking again because it was acceptable, no, I couldn't do drugs, but at least you could drink. That was when I got myself into trouble again.
Oh no. Okay. I didn't even know about that part of the story. So basically you become an alcoholic.
Yeah, so the show that you see where I'm being arrested and I'm crying and my mugshot's all over TMZ was after a night of drinking. I was out drinking with, you know, friends, and I completely blacked out. I don't know if my drink got spiked or what happened, but I completely blacked out, and I'm banging on doors in my neighborhood asking for my kids and my nanny. And that's how I got arrested, was because I was just so completely drunk out of my mind that I had no idea where I was, and I'm 2.5 miles away from my house knocking on strangers' doors. So you can imagine their surprise when they open their door at 4 a.m. and it's Doug the Bounty Hunter's daughter saying, where are my kids?
Exactly. And then that basically then it's the lookout, the chase after you to find you after what happens. That's the episode I saw. Now you're definitely, you're very smart about those things. I didn't tell you exactly which show, but I think you were kind of figuring out timelines and figured out where it was. So Lisa, you again, did you have to get help with an alcoholic, or you said, no, it's a situation where, like, I'll give you an example too, Lisa. If I drink more than 2 beers, I can't stop. So I'll just have one or two beers and I'm done, because I know if I drink 5 to 6, it's going to be 10 to 20, because I'm 6'10", 280 pounds. So I can kill a case and a half back in my days as a pro wrestler. So it is what it is. I can take care of it. I know not to do it. So did you have to get help with this alcoholism, or you just said, hey, I just can't touch a drink?
You know, I tried to go really, really extreme. I tried to go to like AA classes. What I did is that scared the crap out of me so bad. My daughter was going to school, coming home, telling me that she saw me on the news getting arrested. I mean, it was horrific, and it scared the crap out of me. I was 23 years old. I had just gone through a divorce from a man. I was, you know, had this baby. I was on this TV show. I mean, I had a lot going on in my life, and not to mention all my past abuse that, you know, had gone on with me. So at that point, I was just completely lost and broken again. And I just went completely the other way. I mean, I went to church every single Sunday and Wednesday and Friday nights. I was at Bible study and I was going to AA classes. And I kind of went too far to the extreme where I lost myself. And it helped me get sober, but I really, really lost myself. And I had forgotten who I was. I thought, you know, this person who had gone through all this crap, she is a really bad person, and now I need to change that person. What I didn't realize is that everything I had went through made me who I was today, and that I just needed to quit drinking. And then I have an addictive personality, and I have an addiction person, and I get addicted to freaking Airborne. I'm like, I gotta have Airborne every day, you know? So I realized a lot about myself during that arrest, and it made me also see my family in a different light because the cameras were there, because they let me sit in jail for 5 hours. I kind of realized, like, is this more out of love, or is this more for rating? you know, I had given birth on the show. I got married on the show. I had given so many of my intimate life. You know, why did they want to air this arrest? Why did they want to put me on blast, you know?
Because of ratings, and that frustrated you, didn't it?
Absolutely.
And did your father, he was not the executive producer, so he could not say, hey, this has got to get taken out.
Well, I mean, my dad has really lost a lot of control when it came to things, and especially when it came to Beth. And Beth and I have always had a hard relationship, so it really came down to the fact that she was upset and wanted me to, you know, kind of eat my mistake and wanted to kind of put me as an example. So when the arrest came and everything happened like that, it went down that way. It made me see my family in a different light. This man who I had grown up with and, you know, all these things, fame changes you and money changes you. And I had realized at that moment that I wasn't sure this was the life for me. This bounty hunter, you know, being a part of this TV show, everything after that arrest, everything kind of switched in me. The way I looked at my family, the way I looked at, you know, my kids, it just completely switched inside me. And I realized that, you know, everybody's out for number one. And I had to start looking out for myself.
So basically at that point, is this when you decided to leave the show, or did you have another season after this happened?
I had another season after that. And everything kind of fell apart internally in the show. Not only was I having these thoughts, but things were going on with my brother, Duane Lee. Things were going on with my brother, Leland. Everyone kind of internally, it just fell apart. It exploded. It was like the Beatles. You know, everyone wanted more money. Everyone wanted their own contract and this and that. And it just fell to crap. And A&E said, you know, we don't want to deal with it. And they walked away.
Oh, so I didn't even know this. So the show got canceled after that point.
Show got canceled after that point. Yes.
See, I didn't even know that.
We couldn't come to an agreement. You know, we were the highest rated show on A&E. Our ratings hadn't dropped. Our ratings hadn't dropped at all. We were, you know, doing very well. Still number one on the network, and it was an agreement problem. That's why they never renewed us. And they knew that we had eternally, as a family, fallen apart.
So after the show canceled, so you're basically still around your father and all that stuff. It's just that you're not on the TV show anymore. So
I kept him in my life. What I did is I started, that was when I contacted my agent, Charlene Martin. I contacted people. I told them about my story and my life. As soon as I realized that the show was tanking, I was like, what am I going to do? I had a little bit of money that I'd been sitting on. You know, when you're poor and you have money, you don't spend it. So I did not spend it. I hoarded everything. And so I took that money and I put it into getting a proposal done for my book. I put it into a lease for my new store. I took every Dog the Bounty Hunter cent that I had left and spent it on, you know, my new future. And I don't think anyone else in the family did that. You know, they were kind of buying new cars and new shoes and new sunglasses. And, you know, I was just over here like, I'm going to write a book and I'm going to do these things. And everyone was like, oh, yeah, sure you are, sure you are. And then when the show went down, I had, you know, all these things to fall back on.
That's very smart. I see that in my life, and I see because I guess being in professional wrestling, it helped me understand that, because I was a rock bottom at certain times, but I always am looking at the next opportunity happening, because you never know when that other opportunity just falls apart, and you always look for those things, and that's so key. So now the book, what's going on with the book, and then we'll be able to finish up this interesting interview. We could have part four. You're so interesting, Lisa, but I have an idea. You want to be a talk show host, you're welcome to bring on your friends from Dog the Bounty Hunter and all these different places and interview them with me. We'll get it set up. I'll do it. Mary Ammons and I have Real Talk with the Real Housewives, so let's come up with a segment for you.
Awesome. I would love to. Let's do that. I'd love to.
All right. Well, fantastic. So tell us about what's going on with the book now. Update on the book.
The book came out May 7th. It is just doing very, very well. I have gotten so many overwhelming messages, calls, letters, just people telling me how much it touched their lives and changed their lives, and it's just been an incredible journey. I went on a book tour all through the Midwest and then down to Nashville and through New York, and I met my fans face-to-face, and, you know, some places I would go to, there'd be two people waiting for me. Some places I'd go to, there'd be 150. So it was just a really, really amazing journey, and I did a lot of driving. I drove myself all around, and as I was driving in that car, I just thanked God. You know, I would just almost start crying because I was just so thankful. I would think of my life back when I was that little girl in that tree house, and then here I was driving myself around to all my book tours, my fans who were waiting for me, and there's just no words. You know, I wish I could save that moment in a bottle because I was just the happiest girl alive. And I'm just so grateful for everything I've been given, and I'm in a really good place.
Well, I believe you're in a great place. So where can our listeners purchase your book and learn more about you? And I guess, Lisa, next month you start your segment, so we'll have to say babies. We'll come up with a segment name, and then you start bringing people on. If it starts out with people that are involved with your family that have been on the show, that's fine. But if it's other celebrities, we'll just bring them together, and you'll have your talk show. I'll make it happen.
Awesome. I'm so, so excited.
All right, so where can we find info, Lisa?
You can find the book online and in stores everywhere, or you can go to my website, lisachapman.net, and there's ordering options available there.
Well, thanks a lot, Lisa, for calling the program. Look forward to talking to you off air, and I'm looking forward to our segment next month. It's just so cool because you and I hit it off. I know that you and you want to dream, you want to do a talk show. Let's do it. Let's give you the big audience and let you have fun bringing on people that you want to just have a conversation with, because you and I are both conversational stylist people. We both were in different types of lives before what we are today. You're an author.
Yeah.
I'm an educator and an entrepreneur. But before, I was just a pro wrestler, you know, in the small towns all over the country, educated somewhat, but really have lived some challenging parts of my life. So I think we really, that's where we made our connection. So thanks for calling, Lisa, and we'll stay in touch.
Thank you. Have a great day.
You too. You're listening to the Toll-Education Bye. Celebrity Show, and we'll be back in just a moment. We're back to the Total Education Celebrity Show on the Total Education Network. TotalTutor.net for more information. Twitter, Total Tutor, Neil S. Haley, Facebook. And I love the Celebrity Show, especially when we have very, very interesting celebrities. So I want to welcome to the program Cassandra O'Neill. And Cassandra, singer, songwriter, keyboardist, composer, and you are currently seen with Prince and the New Power Generation team. Cassandra, thanks for calling.
Thanks so much for having me. How you doing tonight?
Oh, fantastic. It's always great to do radio. If I could do this as a full-time gig, I would love it. I mean, I do about 7 or 8 hours a week of radio already. I'd love to get to the 15 end because I learned so much about different people. So, Cassandra, the way kind of to do this is basically, let's go to the start of how you became an entertainer. When did you finally get that bug? How old were you when you were really said, this is something I want to do?
Music was always a part of my life. Both of my parents were singers and musicians. All my sisters, I'm the youngest of six. Three of my blood sisters and my parents adopted three. So we were all singing. And as I got older, music just began to appeal more so to me, just as a creative outlet. And as I got into junior high and high school and started to play more and, I realized this is what I want to do. You know, I feel like this is what I've been put here to do. I'm pretty decent at it. And so, I would say when I really started to acknowledge it was probably about the age 9 or 10.
At 9 or 10, because your family was in the business, it was not hard to say, oh, by the way, I'm going to do this, right?
The thing is they were out of the business by the time I had gotten to be in that age, and my father was pastoring, but music was always in the household. So it was just, like I said, it was just kind of like what was there all the time. And the more I listened to it and the more I gravitated towards playing, not just being a music lover, but playing music, that was when it really kind of got serious for me. It's like, people can make livings, a good living doing this. You know, I remember seeing Prince in his early days, and Lisa Coleman was his keyboard player. And she was one of the first women that I had seen on the bandstand playing. And that was kind of what kind of sparked the bug.
So you're a huge fan of the movie Purple Rain then, would you say?
Yeah, even before Purple Rain, even before then, I was familiar with Prince when he first came out due to my older sisters listening to his music. So, you know, it was we're talking back in the For You controversy, 1999 days.
Absolutely, and so it's something where you saw this is something you want to do. And when you said you had got the bug, you said you're pretty decent at it. Cassandra, you're very humble then if you're going to say I was pretty decent at it, because anyone that could become a professional musician has to be pretty good.
Yeah, I must say God is good, and I have a gift, and I'm very grateful and thankful for that gift. Because it didn't have to happen to me, you know. It could have been someone else. I could have been, you know, I could have went to college and studied something, you know, some other, you know, occupation that you have to, you know, engineer or something. But I am glad that I'm able to make a living off of being creative and making folks happy and, you know, hopefully forgetting about their problems and issues for a couple of hours and, you know, and watching music, you know, change lives. You know, it's a wonderful feeling.
So how is it that basically you are involved in so many hands in music? You're a singer, songwriter, keyboardist, composer, and musical director. So you wear a lot of hats in different projects, it sounds like.
Mm-hmm. Well, a lot of those fall under the same thing. If I'm, there are some gigs where I'm just a player, you know, where I'm just playing keys. There are some gigs where I'm just, you know, I'm playing and singing. And there are some gigs where I'm playing, singing, and, you know, music directing. So they all fall under the same thing. And if I'm composing, I'm playing, you know? So it's kind of all one kind of doesn't work without the other. And sometimes it can be overwhelming. Like with Prince, I am singing, playing, and musical director as well. But, you know, it's again, they just kind of fall under the same thing. And, you know, with Prince, I'm basically just a task person that makes sure that we know certain songs or whatever. But the creative definitely comes from him. You know, all of it is his vision.
Well, and let's kind of go specifically where you got your big break. And we're going in, the music was your love, and you said, hey, I'm going to do this. And you said, okay, finally, when did you know you were going to be a professional in this and say, hey, and you got your big break. When would you say that happened?
I got my big break. Well, you know, it's weird because the breaks have always been different. Like, I started out in playing in church. So when I got my first big church, you know, that was kind of a big break for me. And then I started playing for a pretty popular gospel artist, and that was another break. And then I did an HBO special with Eddie Griffith, and that was a break. So I'd say that those breaks started coming in, like, 1994. I had moved to L.A. in 91, and you know, just kind of been at the right place at the right time, and the stars kind of came together, and all those things happened all at the same time. All three of those events happened, like, within a year of each other. So
once you got your break, then it just got, you really got busy, it sounds like, with different projects.
Yeah, it just kind of snowballed from there because, you know, the word got out, and that's pretty, you know, that's how you get work is, you know, through word of mouth. And, you know, I was like, who's this girl? You know, she plays really well. You know, and at that time, there really weren't any other females in L.A. that were playing. There was one other lady, and she was an organist. And she did mainly, you know, church stuff. But as far as the mainstream goes, there really wasn't anyone else doing it besides me, which was scary and kind of exciting at the same time, because I knew at that point I wanted to make milestones for women in music, you know, to be able to say, yeah, she was one of the first ones to do it. If I would, you know, if some other young woman saw me, or a young girl, you know, 15, 16, saw me playing and said, wow, if she can do it, I can do it. That's what it was about for me. And that's what it's still about. inspiration.
Were there roadblocks to get to that point where you had your finally got your break?
One more time.
Were there roadblocks in your career getting to that point?
The roadblocks were the woman thing, you know, being female, and sometimes men don't always like being around women in that capacity. So it gets lonely sometimes, and you just deal with it. And you know this going in, you know what I'm saying? But it's one thing knowing it until you experience it. That was one of the roadblocks, and just being in a new city. You know, when I first moved to L.A., you got to go through, you know, people getting to know you and all of that. So I would say those were the two main roadblocks that I had to deal with.
All right. So we're talking to Cassandra O'Neill. We're learning specifically her career. Now, the story of meeting Prince, I mean, and getting to start working with him, was it? You said you were a fan of his for a long time to come. But once it came to being that you were going to work with him, it must have been amazing.
It was. My first encounter with him was when I was playing with Sheila E. I just did a tour with her, and she had asked me then, after the tour, you know, I need you in my band, play with me. And that was, I was so happy. I had been a Sheila E. fan as long as I had been a Prince fan. So that was so much fun for me, and she's such a great person, one of my closest friends. And we were backing him up for the NAACP Awards, the Image Awards. And I was one of five keyboard players, and it was a full horn section, full rhythm section. And that was my first encounter. You want to talk about being scared? I was scared. I was so nervous. I was like, wow, I hope I'm playing everything right. You know, it was just, yeah. But it was a great experience. And that was 2005. And then in 2009, I got the call saying, you know, Prince would like you to come to Minneapolis. Can you come? And I did, and was there for 2 weeks, and ended up doing shows with him in Paris. And the rest, as they say, is history.
So let's talk about the first meeting with him. When you went to Minneapolis, what did you think of Prince when you met him? What was your thought process? And especially for
Well, he has such a calming aura. He's just the nicest guy. I mean, very, very easygoing and laid back. And he was so welcoming, you know. I went to the studio that Saturday afternoon, and we got started right then. He was teaching me parts, and, you know, we just kind of got into it and gave me a big hug. And, you know, he asked me, he said, so how long do I have you? I said, how long do you need me? He said, do you have a coat? I said, sure, because, you know, it gets really cold in Minneapolis. And I'm like, I'm from New York. Of course I have a coat. So, you know, it was really, really easygoing, very comfortable with him.
So then you go on tour with him, and it must be amazing because you're listening to the same songs, playing the same songs that you were listening to when you were so into it. So how electrifying, even at this point in his career, was it touring with him?
Amazing, amazing, because just like you said, you know, these are songs that I've heard before, but the arrangements are a little bit different because he puts breaks and, you know, and transitions and segues and stuff like that. So, you know, it's almost surreal when you're on stage playing a part that you hear on the record, and it's like, and it sounds just like the record. It's like, wow, I'm actually playing this, you know. I pinch myself often.
During rehearsals, is Prince a pretty intense guy during rehearsals?
Oh, yes. Don't stop till you get it right. Yeah. The thing I like about him is he hears it in his head first, and it's so detailed, and he'll say, you know, Cassie, I want you to play this. Bass player, play this. Drummer, play this. singers, I want you to come in on this beat. Horn players, I want you to play this note on this beat and with this chord or whatever. Okay, y'all ready? Here we go. 2, 3, 4. And we do it. And then he'll say something like, wow, this sounded even better than it did in my head. And I'm like, wow, what did it sound like in your head? You know what I mean? So he has this, it's orchestration is already there, and it's just, you know, we're putting it down on paper. It's amazing to be a part of that.
And at times seeing the perfectionism of him and saying, wow, oh, we have to do it again. But then you see the unbelievable creativity that he has in your life.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. It's such a learning experience because he has so many ideas. So many ideas, and there's so many different ways for him to be able to voice certain things and put together certain things, and it's almost like he just picks out of a trick bag, and it always works.
And you, I'm sure, learned a lot as well, and we'll talk about that in the next segment, and especially where your career is going, the big event in New York. We'll talk about all those different things when we get back, more with Cassandra O'Neill. You're listening to Toll Education Celebrity Show on the Toll Education Network, and we'll be back in just a moment. We're back to Toll Education Celebrity Show on the Toll Education Network, TotalTutor.net for more information, Twitter, TotalTutor Neil S. Haley, Facebook. I'm with celebrity Cassandra O'Neill, was part of Prince, and I find it so awesome because, I mean, I remember when Purple Rain came out, and I don't even know how old I was, Cassandra, when I watched it, but you're really kind of picturing to me the intensity that he had, because in that movie, he showed that intensity.
That at all. He's such a giving person, and he's a gentleman's gentleman. He's like a big brother to me, and I've learned so much. And he, you know, like I said, when I got into the organization, he made me feel so comfortable.
So from this process of working with him, I'm sure you are a sponge. It sounds like you are, Cassandra. You're saying, wow, I have to take in and learn so much. You learned so much from Sheila E., then you learned so much from Prince. And that pretty much helps you in that process to become a better and better musician. Learn from the best so you can become the best, correct?
Right, right. Yeah, that's another thing I like about him is he's not afraid to share the information, and he encourages us all the time to do the same thing. You know, he's always saying, you know, we got to teach the young ones. We got to, you know, even though they have YouTube and you know, and Facebook and all these other elements and sources for the musical part, we have to teach them from a personal standpoint, you know, what we went through, and to let them know that there's no shortcut to this. You know, you have to do the work. You know, it may seem like there's a shortcut, but there isn't. And, you know, and he's very, very blunt about, you know, this industry and how to maneuver in it. So, you know, that's another part of the education that I really appreciate.
So you learned all these different things specifically. You toured for how many years with Prince?
I've been with him, it'll be 4 years in October.
Okay, so this is interesting, Cassandra, and reading your bio, I was kind of figuring that out. So you're still with Prince, but you're also pursuing other things as well, correct, while still working with him?
Yeah, I am in school. This is my second semester, pursuing my undergrad and studies, and I'm also working on a solo project as well. So I've got a lot of things happening all at the same time.
What are you going for school for?
I'm going for, well, it's weird because I'm now studying music therapy. At first I was going to be a performance major, but then I realized that I already do that. So I want to pursue something that's music related, that's a little bit different for me. So I've decided to change my major to music therapy.
Interesting. Okay. And music therapy for what?
Well, it's actually more psychological than anything, just how the brain processes music, where it can turn on certain, I guess you can call it endorphins or something. We haven't gotten into that part yet, but how it, the brain can trigger certain endorphins to heal, for the body to heal itself. And, you know, just what triggers the body to become relaxed when it hears certain music. You know, just the deep psyche stuff.
Exactly. I'm familiar with this because I when I was a TSS working with an autistic child, I would go to music therapy classes, and you could see how it really calmed the children with autism. So, I'm sure that'll be discussions in your studies as well, because that's one that's one of the big areas that people look at. But also think of music therapy for people who go through traumatic experiences like post-traumatic stress disorder. They go after they need that music, and also people that are going through really hard times. Or you see the fact that how music changes people's moods. I'm sure when you crack and put on a song, that changes your mood if you had just a bad experience, right?
Oh, yeah, sure. I mean, even as a professional where, you know, you would think that at this point in my career that, you know, I can listen to a song and it doesn't move me. But there are songs that I've listened to as a child, and I still have in my, you know, I have in my iTunes library, and I listen to it, and it takes me back to the first time I heard it as a child. So, you know, music, it has a powerful way of changing the atmosphere. And so, you know, whether that be from happy to sad or sad to happy, soothing, alarming, you know, exciting, you know, it, all these things are under, you know, what music can do. And we've seen that over the years with, you know, with good music, with the production of good music. And, you know, I've seen it change, you know, the atmosphere for sure.
So how are you going full-time to school, or you can't, especially with working with Prince and your solo career?
I did full-time last semester. I can't do it again, so I'm going part-time.
And do your professors understand that you travel sometimes and stuff?
Yeah, they do. They do. And luckily with the school, they, you know, they kind of encourage it, you know, and their whole thing is okay, if you're going to be away, you have to do what you have to do. You know, I was Skyping last semester and, you know, I had students taking notes for me and taping, recording, taping. We don't use cassettes anymore. Recording, my lectures, and then putting them in a Dropbox folder for me. So, you know, using technology to my advantage. And I did pretty decent for my first semester back in school. So,
and how did people respond? Which, I mean, I guess being in L.A., it's not a surprise. Oh, who you were in a way of who you work with and all that. Or you don't say it to anybody when you're sitting in the class.
You know, it got out. I didn't say anything to the students, but I said something to, like, the teachers and, you know, faculty and the dean and people like that. And then the next thing I know, I get a tap on the shoulder, and one of the students is like, "You play for Prince, don't you?" I said, maybe. 'Cause I didn't want any special treatment or anything like that. So, you know, I kind of downplayed it in the beginning, but then after a while, the students started asking me questions because there really is no professional representation at the school except for me. All the students are students. They're all younger than me. They're like in their 20s and just fresh out of high school. So oftentimes I find myself sitting around telling them stories about my travels and who I've worked with and, you know, funny stories and scary stories about, you know, being on the road and the, you know, we had a flat tire and, you know, things like that. They enjoy that. So,
Yeah, I know those stories as well. I don't know if Monica told you I was a former professional wrestler, so I know exactly. I know the travel and the, I mean, just minor leagues, not the big time, but I understand touring and all these different things. So by working for Prince and still having this great experience of saying, I play with Prince, why a solo career? I mean, do you see that the next step is coming for you, and but you don't want to leave what you're doing, but you ultimately want to try something else? What made you say?
It's about expression. It's about expression. The thing is, you know, I'm playing, you know, whoever's music I'm playing for, and, you know, it's their music. You know what I mean? And when people, you know, when we get a chance to solo and, you know, people might hear me sing a little bit and they hear me play, it's like, wow, I wonder what, you know, what stuff she has, you know, and I've kind of shied away from it for years. You know, people are saying, you really need to come out with a project. You need to come out with a project. And I'm like, no, I'm good. But it's about expression and just being able to get out what's inside of me, and, you know, being creative and taking all the influences that I've been able to gather through my experiences and being able to put those down and, you know, people can hear that and, you know, and experience that.
So, okay, let's go to now the next part, which is let's promote what's coming up at the New York City's winery August 20th to 25th during the VMA week. Tell us specifically what's happening.
The NPG will be taking over New York from the 21st, actually, through the 25th, and we'll be at the City Winery. There's going to be a lot of surprise guests. All I know is going to be funky. It's going to be hot. So, you know, bring your fans because it's going to be off the chain. It's going to be off the chain. We're going to have a great time. You're going to hear some old stuff, you're going to hear some new stuff. We're going to have the horn section. The MPG horns are going to be there. It's going to be amazing. It's going to be amazing. You just got to come and see. I don't want to give it away.
Well, I mean, you're already making me excited because I'm a Prince fan. So I'm like, wow, oh my, that would be just unbelievable. And yeah, and it's coming up soon. So I'm sure you're excited. It seems like.
Yeah. We're going to have a good time. It's always great when we get together and play. And, you know, with the horn section, we've had them now for almost a year, and they are so dynamic. Oh, they add such a new energy to what we're doing, and it's great to have them around.
So are you rehearsing a lot coming up to this whole thing? Are you in LA right now, or are you...
No, I'm not in LA. I'm home. We rehearsed a couple of weeks ago, and we're gonna rehearse a little bit more, of course. And you know, we're gonna get it in. You know, and rehearsals are always fun. Rehearsals are fun because they turn into whatever. You know, we start playing one song and then we merge into something else. So it's gonna be fun.
And so, what can you give us a hint of some surprises are gonna be there or not? No, you can't do that.
No. It wouldn't be a surprise.
No, I'm trying to ask a question like that, and you're saying no.
I'll have to
ask Monica. Do you have any idea? You know,
I'm not going to tell her either. you just going to have to come to the show.
I wish I could. Well, there's six choices, but again, with my four kids and my wife expecting our fifth, I'll have to travel some in the next 4 months. But if I would take if I was able to take all the opportunities of traveling, I would never be home,
right?
Because I am so connected in LA because of this radio show, and then I'm connected in other cities, and people pull me in all these different directions. But I definitely want to have you back on to tell us about the experience in New York and all that. So I'm sure your performing must be just something that just gives you that just absolute adrenaline, doesn't it? It's like, it's nothing, it's the greatest thing when you're on stage. It really is.
It is. It really is. And that's exactly what it is, especially when you've done, you know, show after show after show. And then we sometimes do after shows at a, you know, a smaller venue that we play for another 2 hours. But, you know, it's the joy of the music. And, you know, these are experiences that you'll never have again. And so you just take advantage of it. And, you know, the adrenaline definitely gets you through. And then after you're done, you go home and you or go back to your room and you just sleep.
See, when I was a wrestler, and I did the same thing every night, I didn't sleep. I didn't sleep at all. But I guess I could imagine myself if I was trying to travel like this in 40. And this is my stage. My mic, and I'm in the zone, and when I do TV, the same thing. So I appreciate you calling.
Right.
So where can our listeners find information on you about your solo career, also what's going on with the New Power Generation, and also all the different things about you, Cassandra?
Yes, please follow me on Twitter. Cassie Cutie Keys, C-A-S-S-Y, the letter Q, the letter T, and K-E-Y-S at the Twitter. And I'm on Facebook. I have a fan page. You can log on. I try to get on my fan page as much as my personal. I'm also on Social Cam. Social Cam is a lot of fun. I think it's just my name, I believe. You can get me on all those platforms, you know, and don't be afraid to say hello.
Well, I'm really going to say I need to have a follow-up interview with you after this experience, because I just want to know what I missed and say, man, and you even invited me. And it's just I guess someday, if I could keep interviewing like this and just have that same adrenaline, I'm 40 right now, Cassandra, and I'll do the same thing when I'm 60. Then when all my kids are grown up, hey, my wife and I will be traveling all over the world meeting all these awesome people.